administration of divine laws of justice. Accordingly, Sumerian and Babylonian kings opened their inscriptions of self-adoration by describing how Enlil had called them to kingship. These calls, issued by Enlil on behalf of himself and his father Anu, granted legitimacy to the ruler and outlined his functions. Even Hammurabi, who acknowledged a god named Marduk as the national god of Babylon, prefaced his code of laws by stating that Anu and Enlil named me to promote the welfare of the people, to cause justice to prevail in the land. The third great god of Sumer was another son of Anu. He bore two names, Ea and Enki. Like his brother Enlil, he too was a god of heaven and earth, a deity originally of the heavens who had come down to earth. Ea, the name meant literally house water, was a master engineer, planned and supervised the construction of canals, the diking of the rivers, and the draining of the marshlands. As lord of the seas, Ea built ships that sailed to far lands, and especially to places from which precious metals and semi-precious stone were brought to Sumer. Sumerian deluge text, on which the biblical account must have been drawn, depict Ea as the god who, in defiance of the decision of the assembly of gods, enabled a trusted follower, the Mesopotamian Noah, to escape the disaster. Indeed, the Sumerian text, which, like the Old Testament, adhered to the belief that a god or gods created man through a conscious and deliberate act, attribute to Ea a key role. As the chief scientist of the gods, he outlined the method and the process by which man was to be created. Was Ea on the side of man simply because he had a hand in his creation, or did he have other, more subjective motives? Invariably, Ea's defiance, in mortal and divine matters alike, was aimed mostly at frustrating decisions or plans emanating from Enlil. Several biblical tales, of Eve and the serpent in the Garden of Eden, or of the tale of the deluge or the flood, involve in their original Sumerian versions instances of defiance by Ea and his brother's edicts. The reason is given by Enki himself in his autobiography. It was he, not Enlil, who was first born, Enki claimed. Enlil, the son of Anu and his official consort Antu, was the first legal first son. Enki was born first, but to a concubine. The biblical tale of Isaac and Ishmael may have had a prior parallel in the heavenly abode. Several Sumerian epic tales have been found about the arguments and even bloody struggles among the younger gods. Many cylinder seals depict scenes of gods battling gods. It would seem that the original rivalry between Enki and Enlil was carried on and intensified between their sons, with brothers sometimes turning against brother, a divine tale of Cain and Abel. At some point, Enki decided to put his efforts into making a son of his, the third generation successor. This he sought to achieve with the aid of his half-sister, Ninhursag. She, too, was of the heavens. She was the chief nurse, the one in charge of medical facilities. According to the Sumerian text, man was created by Ninhursag following processes and formulas devised by Enki. It was in that role that the goddess was called Ninti, Lady Life. The position of the sons of Anu and Enlil and Enki, and of their offspring in the dynastic lineage, emerges clearly through a unique Sumerian device, the allocation of numerical rank to certain gods. There were many other gods in Sumer, children, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews of the great gods. There were also several hundred rank-and-file gods, called Anunnaki, who were assigned general duties. But only 12 made the great circle. They included Anu, Enlil, and Enki, and spouses, and Ninhursag. Enlil's sons, Ninurta, Ishkur, and Nanna, and the latter's spouse, Ningal. They were joined by Nanner's twin children, Utu and Inanna, who replaced Ninhursag in old age. Sumerian text. Leave no doubt that the peoples of the ancient Near East were certain that the gods of heaven and earth were able to rise from earth and ascend into the heavens, as well as roam earth's skies at will. Such a capability was often indicated by the ancient artist by depicting the gods, anthropomorphic in all other respects, with wings. The wings, as can be seen from numerous depictions, were not a part of the body, not natural wings, but rather a decorative attachment to the god's clothing. Texts described how Inanna very meticulously put on herself 7 objects prior to the start of a voyage. The shugara she put on her head, measuring pendants on her ears, chains of small blue stones around her neck, twin stones on her shoulders, a golden cylinder in her hands, straps clasping her breast, the Pala garment clothed around her body. Though no one has yet been able to explain the nature and significance of these seven objects, we feel that the answer has long been available. Excavating the Assyrian capital Assur from 1903 to 1914, Walter Andre and his colleagues found in the temple of Ishtar a battered statue of the goddess, showing her with various contraptions attached to her chest and back. In 1934, archaeologists excavating the Mare came upon a similar but intact statue buried in the ground. Unlike the flat carvings or bas-relief, this life-size, three-dimensional representation of the goddess reveals interesting features. On her head, she wears a special helmet. Protruding from it on both sides and fitted over the ears are objects that remind one of a pilot's earphones. On her neck and upper chest, the goddess wears a necklace of many small and probably precious stones. In her hands, she holds a cylindrical object, which appears too thick and heavy to be a vase for holding water. Over a blouse of see-through material, two parallel straps run across her chest, leading back to and holding in place an unusual box of rectangular shape. The box is held tight against the back of the goddess's neck and is firmly attached to the helmet with a horizontal strap. Whatever the box held inside must have been heavy, for the contraption is further supported by two large shoulder pads. The weight of the box is increased by a hose that is connected to its base by a circular clasp. The complete package of instruments is held in place with the aid of two sets of straps that crisscross the goddess's back and chest. The parallel between the seven objects required by Inanna for her aerial journeys and the dress and objects worn by the statue from Mare is easily proved. We see that the measuring pendants, the earphones on her ears, the rows of chains of small stones around her neck, the twin stones, the two shoulder pads on her shoulders, the golden cylinder in her hands, and the clasping straps that crisscross her breast. She is indeed clothed in a Pala garment or a ruler's garment, and on her head she wears the Shagara helmet, a term that literally means that which makes go far into the universe. All of this suggests to us that the attire of Inanna was that of an aeronaut or an astronaut. The Old Testament called the angels of the Lord Malachim, literally emissaries who carried divine messages and carried out divine commands. As so many instances reveal, they were divine airmen. Jacob saw them going up a skyladder. Hagar, Abraham's concubine, was addressed by them from the sky, and it was they who brought about the aerial destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Clay figurines found at Sumerian sites and believed to be some 5,500 years old may well be crude representation of such malachim holding wand-like weapons. In one instance, the face is seen through a helmet's visor. In the other instance, the emissary wears the distinct divine conical headdress and a uniform studded with circular objects of unknown function. The eye slots or goggles of the figurines are the most interesting feature because the Near East in the 4th millennium B.C. was literally swamped with wafer-like figurines that depicted in a stylized manner the upper part of the deities, exaggerating their most prominent feature, a conical helmet with elliptical visors or goggles. It is undoubtedly no mere coincidence that the Hittites, linked to Sumer and Akkad, adopted as their written sign for gods a symbol clearly borrowed from the eye figurines. It is also no wonder that this symbol or hieroglyph for divine being expressed in artistic styles came to dominate the art not only of Asia Minor, but also the early Greeks during the Minoan and Mycenaean periods. The Greek legend of Icarus had him attempt to fly by attaching feathered wings to his body with wax. The evidence from the ancient Near East shows that though the gods may have been depicted with wings to indicate their flying capabilities, or perhaps sometimes put on winged uniforms as a mark of their airmanship, they never attempted to use attached wings for flying. Instead, they used vehicles for such travel. The Old Testament informs us that the patriarch Jacob, spending the night in the field outside of Haran, saw a ladder set up on earth and its top reaching heavenwards, on which angels of the Lord were busy going up and down. The Lord himself stood at the top of the ladder, and the astounded Jacob was fearful, and he said, "Indeed, a God is present in this place, and I know it not. How awesome is this place! Indeed, this is none but the Lord's abode, and this is the gateway to heaven." There are two interesting points to this tale. The first is the divine beings going up and down this gateway to heaven were using a mechanical facility, a ladder. The second is that the sight took Jacob completely by surprise. The Lord's abode, the ladder, and the angels of the Lord using it were not there when Jacob lay down to sleep in the field. Suddenly, there was the awesome vision, and by morning, the abode, the ladder, and their occupants gone. We may conclude that the equipment used by the divine beings was some kind of craft that could appear over a place, hover for a while, and disappear from sight once again. The Old Testament also reports that the prophet Elijah did not die on earth, but went up into heaven by a whirlwind. Now, this was not a sudden and unexpected event. The ascent of Elijah to the heavens was prearranged. He was told to go to Bethel, the Lord's house, on a specific day. Rumors had already spread among his disciples that he was about to be taken up into the heavens. When they queried his deputy whether the rumor was true, he confirmed that indeed the Lord will take away the master today. And then there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and Elijah went up into heaven by a whirlwind. Even more celebrated, and certainly better described, was the heavenly chariot seen by the prophet Ezekiel, who dwelt among the Judean deportees on the bank of the Khabur River in northern Mesopotamia. The heavens were opened, and I saw the appearances of the Lord. What Ezekiel saw was a man-like being, surrounded by brilliance and brightness, sitting on a throne that rested on a metal firmament within the chariot. The vehicle itself, which could move whichever way upon wheels within wheels and rise off the ground vertically, was described by the prophet as a glowing whirlwind. Some recent students of the biblical description, such as Joseph F. Bloomridge of NASA, have concluded that the chariot seen by Ezekiel was a helicopter consisting of a cabin resting on four posts, each equipped with rotary